from her position in the window. The trees hid most of the backyard, and she stretched a bit to see beyond their spread. Then a mighty hand dug deep into a giant sack and threw fistfuls of petals into the air. Or so it seemed. Butterflies, a trembling highway of persimmon-colored wings, cut across the green treetops forever, then vanished. Later, as she sat in a rocker under those trees, he came by. She had never seen him before and did not recognize any local family in his features. At first, she thought it was Menas, Harper's son, who drank and who once had owned the house. But this man was walking straight and quickly, as though late for an appointment, using this yard as a shortcut to someplace else. Perhaps he heard the light cry of her rocker. Perhaps he wondered whether his trespass was safe. In any case, when he turned and saw her, he smiled, raising a palm in greeting. "Afternoon," she called. He changed his direction and came near to where she sat. "You from around here?" "Close," he said, but he did not move his lips to say so. He needed a haircut. "I saw some butterflies a while back. Up there," Davy pointed. "Orangey red they were, just as bright. Never saw that color before, like what we used to call coral when I was a girl. Pumpkin color, but stronger." She wondered at the time what on earth she was talking about, and would have stuttered to a polite close, something about the heat, probably, the relief evening would bring, except he looked so interested in what she was describing. His overalls were clean and freshly ironed. The sleeves of his white shirt were rolled above the elbows. His forearms, smoothly muscled, made her reconsider the impression she got from his face that he was underfed. "You ever see butterflies like that?" He shook his head, but evidently thought the question serious enough for him to sit on his heels before her. "Don't let me keep you from where you were going. It was just, well, my Lord, such a sight." He smiled sympathetically and looked toward the place she had pointed to. Then he stood up, brushing the seat of his overalls, although he had not sat down in the grass, and said, "Is it all right if I pass through here?" "Of course, any time. Nobody lives here now. The man who owned it lost it. Nice though, isn't it? We think about maybe using it from time to time. My husband," she was babbling, she knew, but he seemed to be listening earnestly, carefully, to every word. At last she stopped, too ashamed of her silliness to go on, and repeated her invitation to use the shortcut whenever he wanted. He thanked her and left the yard, moving quickly between the trees. Dovey watched his figure melt in the shadow lace veiling the houses beyond. She never saw the persimmon wings again. He, however, did return about a month later, then off and on every month or two. Dovey kept forgetting to ask Stewart or anybody else who he might be. Young people were getting harder to identify, and when friends or relatives visited Ruby, they did not always attend services as people used to and get introduced to the congregation. She could not ask his age, but supposed he was at least 20 years younger than she, and perhaps that alone made her keep his visits secret. Thing was, when he came, she talked nonsense. things she didn't know were on her mind. Pleasures, worries, things unrelated to the world's serious issues. Yet he listened intently to whatever she said. By a divining she could not explain, she knew that once she asked him his name, he would never come again. Once she fed him a slice of bread loaded with apple butter, and he ate it all. More and more frequently, she found reasons to remain on St. Matthew Street, not hoping or looking for him, but content to know he had and would come by there for a chat, a bite, cool water on a parched afternoon. Her only fear was that someone else would mention him, appear in his company, or announce a prior claim to his friendship. No one did. He seemed hers alone. So, on the evening of the argument with the young people at Mount Calvary, Dovey stuck the key in the lock of the foreclosed house, annoyed with Stewart for making it necessary and agitated by the nasty turn the meeting had taken. She hoped to sit with a cup of hot tea, read some verses or a few psalms, and collect her thoughts on the matter that was angering everybody, in case her friend passed by in the morning. If he did, she would ask his opinion. But she had decided against tea or reading, and after saying her prayers, climbed into bed, where an unanswerable question blocked sleep. Aside from giving up his wealth, can a rich man be a good one? She would ask her friend about that too. Now at least, at last, the backyard was lovely enough to receive him. At the first visit, it had been a mess, untended, trashy, home to cats, garden snakes, straying chickens, with only the coral-colored wings to recommend it. She had to fix it up herself. KD balked and gave unimaginative excuses, and it was hard getting young people interested. Billy Delia used to be her helper, which was surprising, since boys dominated her brain otherwise. But something was wrong there, too. No one had seen her for some time, and the girl's mother, Pat Best, foreclosed all questions. Still angry, thought Dovey, at the town's treatment of her father. Although Billy Delia was not at the meeting, her attitude was. Even as a little girl, with that odd, rosy-tanned skin and wayward brown hair, she pushed out her lips at everything, everything but gardening. Dovey missed her and wondered what Billy Delia thought of changing the oven's message. Beware the furrow of his brow. Be the furrow of his brow. Her opinion was that furrow of his brow alone was enough for any age or generation. Specifying it, particularizing it, nailing its meaning down was futile. The only nailing needing to be done had already taken place on the cross. Wasn't that so? She'd ask her friend, and then tell Song. Meantime, the scratching sound was gone, and on the cusp of sleep, she knew canned peas would do just fine. Stewart rolled down the window and spit, carefully, so the wind would not return it to his face. He was disgusted. Cut me some slack. That was the slogan these young simpletons really wanted to paint on the oven. Like his nephew, KD, they had no notion of what it took to build this town, what they were protected from, what humiliations they did not have to face. Driving, as always, as fast as the car would go, Once he was back on the county road, heading for his ranch, Stewart mulled over the difference between beware and be, and how Big Papa would have explained it. Personally, he didn't give a damn. The point was not why it should or should not be changed, but what Reverend Meisner gained by instigating the idea. He spat again, thinking how much of a fool Meisner turned out to be, foolish and maybe even dangerous. He wondered if that generation, Meisner's and KD's, would have to be sacrificed to get to the next one, the grand and great-grandchildren who could be trained, honed, as his own father and grandfather had done for Stewart's generation. No breaks there. No slack cut then. Expectations were high and met. Nobody took more responsibility for their behavior than those good men. He remembered his brother's, Elder Morgan's, account of disembarking from Liverpool at a New Jersey port, Hoboken, in 1919, taking a walk around New York City before catching his train. He saw two men arguing with a woman. From her clothes, Elder said he guessed she was a streetwalking woman, and registering contempt for her trade, he felt at first a connection with the shouting men. Suddenly, one of the men smashed the woman in her face with his fist. She fell. Just as suddenly, the scene slid from everyday color to black and white. Elder said his mouth went dry. The two white men turned away from the unconscious Negro woman sprawled on the pavement. Before Elder could think, one of them changed his mind and came back to kick her in the stomach. Elder did not know he was running until he got there and pulled the man away. He had been running and fighting for 10 straight months, still unweaned from spontaneous violence. Elder hit the white man in the jaw and kept hitting until attacked by the second man. Nobody won. All were bruised. The woman was still lying on the pavement when a small crowd began yelling for the police. Frightened, Elder ran and wore his army overcoat all the way back to Oklahoma for fear an officer would see the condition of his uniform. Later, when his wife, Susanna, cleaned, pressed, and mended it, he told her to remove the stitches, to let the jacket pocket flap, the shirt collar stay ripped, the buttons hang or remain missing. It was too late to save the bloodstains, so he tucked the bloody handkerchief into the pants pocket along with his two medals. He never got the sight of that white man's fist in that colored woman's face out of his mind. Whatever he felt about her trade, he thought about her, prayed for her, till the end of his life. Susanna put up a protracted argument, but the Morgan men won. Elder was buried, as he demanded to be, in the uniform with his rips on display. He didn't excuse himself for running, abandoning the woman, and he didn't expect God to cut him any slack for it, and he was prepared for him to ask how it happened. Stewart liked that story, but it unnerved him to know it was based on the defense of and prayers for a whore. He did not sympathize with the white men, but he could see their point, could even feel the adrenaline, imagining the fist was his own. Stewart parked and entered the house. He did not look forward to any bed without Dovey in it, and tried again to think of an argument to keep her from staying in town so often. It would be futile. He could deny her nothing. He met the collies and took them along to see how well the hands had done their work. They were local men whose wives and fathers he knew, who attended the same or a nearby church, and who hated as he did the notion of cut me some slack. Again the bitterness rose. Had he any sons, they would have been sterling examples of rectitude, laughing at Meisner's notions of manhood, backtalk, name changes, as if word magic had anything to do with the courage it took to be a man. Steward leashed the dogs and unlatched the horse barn. His preference was to mount around 4 a.m. and ride night till sunrise. He loved to roam the pastures where everything was in the open. Saddled on night, he rediscovered every time the fresh wonder of knowing that on one's own land, you could never be lost the way Big Papa and Big Daddy and all 79 were after leaving Fairley, Oklahoma. On foot and completely lost, they were. And angry, but not afraid of anything except the condition of the children's feet. By and large, they were healthy, but the pregnant women needed more and more rest. Drum Black Horse's wife, Celeste, his grandmother, Miss Mindy, and Beck, his own mother, were all with child. It was the shame of seeing one's pregnant wife or sister or daughter refused shelter that had rocked them and changed them for all time. The humiliation did more than rankle. It threatened to crack open their bones. Steward remembered every detail of the story his father and grandfather told, and had no trouble imagining the shame for himself. Dovey, for instance, before each miscarriage, her hand resting on the small of her back, her eyes narrowed, looking inward, always inward, at the baby inside her. How would he have felt if some highfalutin men in collars and good shoes had told her, "Get away from here," and he, Steward, couldn't do a thing about it? Even now, in 1973, riding his own land with free wind blowing night's mane, the thought of that level of helplessness made him want to shoot somebody. 79. All their belongings strapped to their backs or riding on their heads. Young ones, time-sharing shoes, stopping only to relieve themselves, sleep, and eat trash. Trash and boiled meal. Trash and meal cake. Trash and game. Trash and dandelion greens. Dreaming of a roof, fish, rice, syrup. Raggedy as sauerkraut, they dreamed of clean clothes with buttons, shirts, with both sleeves. They walked in a line. Drum and Thomas Black Horse at the head. Big Papa, lame now, carried sitting up on a plank at the tail. After Fairley, they didn't know which way to go and didn't want to meet anybody who might tell them or have something else in mind. They kept away from wagon trails, tried to stay closer to pine woods and stream beds, heading northwest for no particular reason other than it seemed farthest away from Fairley. The third night, Big Papa woke his son, Rector, and motioned for him to get up. Leaning heavily on two sticks, he moved a ways off from the campsite and whispered, "Follow me, you." Rector went back for his hat and followed his father's slow, painful steps. He thought, with alarm, that the old man was going to try to get to a town in the middle of the night, or apply to one of the farms where dark sod houses nestled up against a hillock. But Big Papa took him deeper into the piney wood, where the odor of resin, lovely at first, soon gave him a headache. The sky was brilliant with stars that dwarfed the crescent moon, turning it into a shed feather. Big Papa stopped and with groaning effort knelt down. "My father," he said, "Zechariah here." Then, after a few seconds of total silence, he began to hum the sweetest, saddest sounds Rector ever heard. Rector joined Big Papa on his knees and stayed that way all night. He dared not touch the old man or interfere with his humming prayer, but he couldn't keep up and sat back on his haunches to relieve the pain in his knees. After a while, he sat all the way down, holding his hat in his hand, his head bowed, trying to listen, stay awake, understand. Finally, he lay on his back and watched the star trail above the trees. The heartbreaking music swallowed him, and he felt himself floating inches above the ground. He swore later that he did not fall asleep, that during the whole night he listened and watched. Surrounded by pine trees, he felt rather than saw the sky fading at ground line. It was then he heard the footsteps, loud like a giant's tread. Big Papa, who had not moved a muscle or paused in his song, was quickly silent. Rector sat up and looked around. The footsteps were thundering, but he couldn't tell from which direction they came. As the hem of skylight widened, he could make out the silhouettes of tree trunks. They saw him at the same time. A small man, seemed like, too small for the sound of his steps. He was walking away from them, dressed in a black suit, the jacket held over his shoulder with the forefinger of his right hand, his shirt glistening white between broad suspenders. Without the help of a stick and with nary a groan, Big Papa stood up. Together they watched the man walking away from the palest part of the sky. Once he lingered to turn around and look at them, but they could not see the features of his face. When he began walking again, they noticed he had a satchel in his left hand. "Run," said Big Papa, "gather the people." "You can't stay here by yourself," said Rector. "Run," and Rector did. When everyone was roused, Rector led them to where he and Big Papa had spent the night. They found him right there, standing straighter than the pines, his sticks tossed away, his back to the rising sun. No walking man was in sight, but the peace that washed Zechariah's face spread to their own spirits, calming them. "He is with us," said Zechariah. "He is leading the way." From then on, the journey was purposeful, free of the slightest complaints. Every now and then, the walking man reappeared along a riverbed, at the crest of a hill, leaning against a rock formation. Only once did someone gather courage to ask Big Papa how long it might take. "This is God's time," he answered. "You can't start it, and you can't stop it. And another thing, he's not going to do your work for you, so step lively." If the loud footsteps continued, they did not hear them. Nobody saw the walking man but Zechariah and sometimes a child. Rector never saw him again until the end, until 29 days later, after being warned away by gunshot, offered food by some black women in a field, robbed of their rifles by two cowboys, none of which disturbed their determined peace. Rector and his father both saw him. It was September by then. Any other travelers would be cautious going into Indian country with no destination and winter on the way. But if they were uneasy, it didn't show. Rector was lying in tall grass, waiting for a crude trap to spring. Rabbit, he hoped. Groundhog, gopher even. When just ahead, through a parting in the grass, he saw the walking man, standing, looking around. Then the man squatted, opened his satchel, and began rummaging in it. Rector watched for a while, then crawled backward through the grass before jumping up and running back to the campsite where Big Papa was finishing a cold breakfast. Rector described what he had seen, and the two headed toward the place where the trap had been set. The walking man was still there, removing items from his satchel and putting others back. Even as they watched, the man began to fade. When he was completely dissolved, they heard the footsteps again, pounding in a direction they could not determine, in back, to the left, now to the right, or was it overhead? Then, suddenly, it was quiet. Rector crept forward. Big Papa was crawling too, to see what the walker had left behind. Before they had gone 3 yards, they heard a thrashing in the grass. There in the trap, bait and pull string undisturbed, was a guinea fowl. Male, with plumage to beat the band. Exchanging looks, they left it there and moved to the spot where they believed the walker had spread the items from his satchel. Not a thing in sight, only a depression in the grass. Big Papa leaned down to touch it, pressing his hand into the flattened grass. He closed his eyes. "Here," he said, "this is our place." Well, it wasn't, of course. Not yet, anyway. It belonged to a family of state Indians, and it took a year and 4 months of negotiation, of labor for land, to finally have it free and clear. Coming from lush vegetation to extravagant space could have made them feel small when they saw more sky than earth, grass to their hips. To the old fathers, it signaled luxury, an amplitude of soul and stature that was freedom without borders and without deep, menacing woods where enemies could hide. Here, freedom was not entertainment, like a carnival or a hoedown that you can count on once a year. Nor was it the table droppings from the entitled. Here, freedom was a test administered by the natural world that a man had to take for himself every day. And if he passed enough tests long enough, he was king. Maybe Zachariah never wanted to eat another stick-roasted rabbit or cold buffalo meat. Maybe, having been routed from office by whites, refused a homestead by coloreds, he wanted to make a permanent feature in that open land so different from Louisiana. Anyway, while they set up temporary quarters, lean-tos, dugouts, and hauled wood in a wagon with 2 horses the state Indians lent them, Zechariah corralled some of the men into building a cook oven. They were proud that none of their women had ever worked in a white man's kitchen or nursed a white child. Although field labor was harder and carried no status, they believed the rape of women who worked in white kitchens was, if not a certainty, a distinct possibility, neither of which they could bear to contemplate. So they exchanged that danger for the relative safety of brutal work. It was that thinking that made a community kitchen so agreeable. They were extraordinary. They had served, picked, plowed, and traded in Louisiana since 1755, when it included Mississippi, and when it was divided into states they had helped govern, both from 1868 to 1875, after which they had been reduced to field labor. They had kept the issue of their loins fruitful for more than 200 years. They had denied each other nothing, bowed to no one, knelt only to their Maker. Now, remembering their lives and works, Stuart was steadied, his resolve cemented. Imagine, he thought, what Big Papa, or Drum Black Horse, or Juvenal Dupré would think of those puppies who wanted to alter words of beaten iron. The sun wasn't due to rise for some time, and Stuart couldn't ride that long anymore. So he urged Knight around and headed toward home, thinking up another thing he would say or do to keep Dovey from spending nights in town. Sleep without the fragrance of her hair next to him was impossible. At the same moment, before morning light, Soane was standing in the kitchen of the biggest house in Ruby, whispering to the darkness outside the window. Look out, Quail. Deke's gunning for you, and when he comes back, he'll throw a sack full of you on my clean floor and say something like, this ought to take care of supper. Proud, like he's giving me a present, like you were already plucked, cleaned, and cooked. Because the kitchen was flooded with newly installed fluorescent light, Soane could not see into the darkness outside as she waited for the kettle to boil. She wanted to get her tonic properly steeped before her husband returned. One of Connie's preparations lay at her fingertips, a tiny cloth bag folded into a waxed paper packet, its contents representing the second time Connie had saved her. The first time, a terrible mistake. No, not a mistake, a sin. She thought it was midnight when Deke eased out of bed and dressed in hunting clothes. But when he crept downstairs in sock feet, she looked at the clock glow. 3:30. 2 hours more of sleep, she thought. But it was 6 a.m. when she woke, and she had to hurry, get breakfast, lay out his business clothes. Before that, however, her tonic, very much needed now, because the air was thinning again. It had started thinning out, as if from too much wear, not when Scout was killed, but 2 weeks later, even before Scout's body had been shipped, when they were informed that Easter was dead too. Babies, 119, the other 21. How proud and happy she was when they enlisted. She had actively encouraged them to do so. Their father had served in the 40s. Uncles, too. Jeff Fleetwood was back from Vietnam none the worse, and although he did seem a little shook up, Menace Jury got back alive. Like a fool, she believed her sons would be safe, safer than anywhere in Oklahoma outside Ruby, safer in the Army than in Chicago, where Easter wanted to go, safer than Birmingham, than Montgomery, Selma, than Watts, safer than Money, Mississippi in 1955, and Jackson, Mississippi in 1963, safer than Newark, Detroit, Washington, D.C. She had thought war was safer than any city in the United States. Now she had 4 unopened letters mailed in 1968 and delivered to the Denby post office 4 days after she buried the last of her sons. She had never been able to open them. Both had been home on furlough that Thanksgiving, 1968, 7 months after King's murder, and Soane had sobbed like the redeemed, to see both her boys alive. Her sweet colored boys, unshot, unlynched, unmolested, unimprisoned. "Prayer works," she shouted when they piled out of the car. It was the last time she had seen them whole. Connie had sold her shelled pecans enough for 2 Thanksgiving pies. A girl with a broke-down car was out there that day, and although Sohn drove her to buy the gasoline she needed to go where she was headed, the girl had stayed on. Still, she must have gone off somewhere before the mother died. Otherwise, Connie would not have needed to light a fire in the fields. Nobody would have known except for the plume of black smoke. Anna Flood saw it, drove out, and got the news. Sohn had to hurry in, too. Speak to Roger, go to the bank, to telephone strangers up north, collect food from her neighbor women, and cook some things herself. She, Dovey, and Anna carried it out there, knowing full well there was no one to eat it but themselves. Hurry, hurry then too, because the body had to be shipped quickly up north, in ice. Connie seemed strange, broken somehow, and Sohn added her to the list of people who worried her life. K.D., for example, and Arnett, and Sweetie, and now the oven sight was on her mind. A few young men had taken to congregating there, with 3.2 beer, people said, and the small children who liked to play there had been told to go home, or so their mothers said. Then a few girls, who Sohn thought needed slapping, found reason to be there, the way Arnett and Billy Delia used to. Folks said these young men needed something to do. But Sohn, knowing there was so much to do, didn't believe that was it. Something was going on. Something besides the fist, jet black with red fingernails, painted on the back wall of the oven. Nobody claimed responsibility. But more shocking than the collective denial was the refusal to remove it. The loungers said no, they hadn't put it there, and no, they wouldn't take it off. Although Kate Golightly and Anna Flood with Brillo, paint thinner, and a bucket of hot, soapy water eventually got it off. 5 days passed, during which the town leaders, in a hot rage, forbade anyone but the loungers to erase it. The clenched fingers, red-tipped, and thrust sideways, not up, hurt more than a blow and lasted longer. It produced a nagging, hateful pain that Kate's and Anna's scrubbing could not erase. Sohn couldn't understand it. There were no whites, moral or malevolent, around to agitate or incense them, make them ugly up the oven and defy the adults. In fact, local citizens were prospering, had been on a roll for more than a decade. Good dollars for beef, for wheat, gas rights sold, oil fueling purchases, and backing speculation. But during the war, while Ruby thrived, anger smallpoxed other places. Evil times, said Reverend Pulliam from New Zion's pulpit. Last days, said Pastor Carey at Holy Redeemer. Nothing was said at Calvary right away, because that congregation was still waiting for the new preacher who, when he did come in 1970, said, "Good news, I will vanquish thine enemies before thine eyes, saith the Lord, Lord, Lord." That was 3 years ago. This was 1973. Her little girl, was it, would be 19 years old now, if Sohn had not gone to the convent for the help Sin always needed. Shortly afterwards, standing at the clothesline, struggling with the wind to pin sheets, Soane had looked up to see a lady in the yard smiling. She wore a brown wool gown and a white linen old-timey bonnet and carried a peck basket. When the lady waved, Soane returned the stranger's greeting as best she could with a mouthful of clothespins, a nod she hoped was polite. The lady turned and moved on. Soane noticed two things. The basket was empty, but the lady carried it with two hands, as though it were full, which, as she knew now, was a sign of what was to come, an emptiness that would weigh her down, an absence too heavy to carry. And she knew who sent the lady to tell her so. Steam hiss interrupted her menu of regret, and Soane poured hot water into a cup over the little muslin bag. She placed the saucer over the cup and let the medicine steep. Maybe they ought to go back to the way they did things when her babies were new, when everybody was too busy building, stocking, harvesting to quarrel or think up devilment. The way it was before Mount Calvary was completed, when baptisms were held in sweet water. Beautiful baptisms, baptisms to break the heart, full of major chords and weeping and the thrill of being safe at last. When the pastor held the girls in his arms, lowering them one by one into newly hallowed water, never letting go. Breathless, the others watched. Breathless, the girls rose, each in her turn, their wet, white robes billow in sunlit water. Hair and face streaming, they looked to heaven before bowing their heads for the command, "Go now." Then the reassurance, "Daughter, thou art saved." The softest note, when it hit sanctified water, doubled, trebled itself. Then other notes from other throats came and traveled along with the first. Tree birds hushed and tried to learn. Slowly then, hand in hand, heads on supporting shoulders, the blessed and saved waded to the banks and made their way to the oven to dry, embrace, congratulate one another. Now Calvary had an inside pool. New Zion and Holy Redeemer had special vessels for dribbling a little water on an upright head. Minus the baptisms, the oven had no real value. What was needed back in Haven's early days had never been needed in Ruby. The trucks they came in brought cook stoves as well. The meat they ate clucked in the yard, or fell on its knees under a hammer, or squealed through a slice in its throat. Unlike at Haven's beginning, when Ruby was founded, hunting game was a game. The women nodded when the men took the oven apart, packed, moved, and reassembled it. But privately, they resented the truck space given over to it, rather than a few more sacks of seed, rather than shoats, or even a child's crib. Resented also the hours spent putting it back together, hours that could have been spent getting the privy door on sooner. If the plaque was so important, and judging from the part of the meeting she had witnessed, she supposed it was, why hadn't they just taken it by itself, left the bricks where they had stood for 50 years? Oh, how the men loved putting it back together, how proud it had made them, how devoted. A good thing, she thought, as far as it went, but it went too far. a utility, became a shrine, cautioned against not only in scary Deuteronomy, but in lovely Corinthians too, as well. And, like anything that offended him, destroyed its own self. Nobody better to make the point than the wayward young who turned it into a different kind of oven, one where the warming flesh was human. When Royal and the other two, Destry and one of Pius Dupre's daughters, asked for a meeting, it was quickly agreed upon. No one had called a town meeting in years. Everybody, including Soane and Dovey, thought the young people would first apologize for their behavior and then pledge to clean up and maintain the site. Instead, they came with a plan of their own, a plan that completed what the fists had begun. Royal, called Roy, took the floor and, without notes, gave a speech perfect in every way but intelligibility. Nobody knew what he was talking about, and the parts that could be understood were plumb foolish. He said they were way out of date, that things had changed everywhere but in Ruby. He wanted to give the oven a name, to have meetings there, to talk about how handsome they were while giving themselves ugly names, like Not American, like African. All Soane knew about Africa was the 75 cents she gave to the Missionary Society collection. She had the same level of interest in Africans as they had in her. None. But Roy talked about them like they were neighbors, or worse, family. And he talked about white people as though he had just discovered them and seemed to think what he'd learned was news. Yet there was something more and else in his speech. Not so much what could be agreed or disagreed with, but a kind of winged accusation. Against whites, yes, but also against them, the townspeople listening, their own parents, grandparents, the Ruby grown folk, as though there was a new and more manly way to deal with whites. Not the Black Horse or Morgan way, but some African-type thing full of new words, new color combinations, and new haircuts, suggesting that outsmarting whites was craven, that they had to be told, rejected, confronted, because the old way was slow, limited to just a few, and weak. This last accusation swole Deke's neck, and, on a weekday, had him blowing out the brains of Coyle to keep his own from exploding. He would be pulling in with a bag of them any minute now, and later on, Soane would serve up a platter of their tender, browned halves. So she contemplated rice or sweet potatoes as the contents of her cup steeped. When she swallowed the last drop, the back door opened. What's that? She liked the smell of him, windy, wet, and grassy. Nothing. Deke tossed his sack on the floor. Give me some of it then. Go on, Deke. How many? 12. Gave 6 to Sergeant. Deke sat down and, before taking off his jacket, unlaced his boots. Enough to take care of 2 suppers. KD go with you? No. Why? He grunted with the effort of debooting. Soane picked up the boots and put them on the back porch. He's hard to find these days. Up to something, I bet. You put coffee on? Like what? Soane sniffed the dark air, testing its weight before closing the door. Can't tell exactly, but he has too many reasons for wearing thin shoes. Chasing tail, I expect. Remember that gal dragged herself in town, some time back and was staying out to that convent? Soane turned to him, coffee tin at her breast, as she eased off the lid. Why you say dragged? Why you have to say dragged like that? You see her? No, but other folks did. And? Deke yawned. And nothing. Coffee, baby. Coffee. Coffee. So don't say dragged. Okay, okay. She didn't drag in. Deke laughed, dropping his outer clothes on the floor. She floated in. What's wrong with the closet, Deke? Soane looked at the waterproof pants, the black and red jacket, the flannel shirt. And what's that supposed to mean? Heard her shoes had 6-inch heels. You lying and flying. Well, if she's still at the convent, she must be all right. Deke massaged his toes. You just partial to those women out there. I'd be careful if I was you. How many of them now? 4? 3. The old lady died, remember? Deke stared at her, then looked away. What old lady? The Reverend Mother. Who'd you think? Oh, right. Yeah. Deke continued, stirring the blood in his feet. Then he laughed. First time Roger got to use his big new van. Ambulance, said Soane, gathering up his clothes. Brought 3 payments in the next day. Hope he could keep up the rest. Not enough hospital or mortuary business around here. Justify that overpriced buggy he got. The coffee smell was starting, and Deke rubbed his palms. Is he hurting? Soane asked. Not yet. But since his profit depends on the sick and the dead, I just as soon he went bankrupt. Deke couldn't do a damn thing for my boys, buried in a bag like kittens. They had lovely coffins. Lovely. Yeah, but inside. Quit, Deke. Why don't you just quit? Soane touched her throat. I expect he'll make out if I go before he does. In which case, well, you know what to do. I don't feature riding in that van nohow, but I want a top-of-the-line box, so he'll make out just fine. Fleet's the one in trouble. He stood at the sink and lathered his hands. You keep saying that. How come? Mail order. What? Soane poured coffee into the big blue cup her husband preferred. You all go to Denby, don't you? When you want a toaster or an electric iron, you order out of a catalog and go all the way out there to pick it up. Where's that put him? Fleet never has much on hand, and what he does have has been there too long. That lounge chair changed colors 3 times sitting in the window. That's why, said Deke. If he can't move old inventory, he can't buy new. He used to do all right. Deke tipped a little coffee into the saucer. 10 years ago. 5. The dark pool rippled under his breath. Boys coming out of Vietnam, getting married, setting up, war money, farms doing okay. Everybody was doing okay. He sucked at the saucer rim and sighed his pleasure. Now, well, I don't understand, Deke. I do. He smiled up at her. You don't need to. She had not meant that she didn't understand what he was talking about. She'd meant she didn't understand why he wasn't worried enough by their friends' money problems to help them out. Why, for instance, couldn't Menace have kept the house he bought? But Soane didn't try to explain. She just looked closely at his face, smooth, still handsome, after 26 years, and beaming now with satisfaction. Shooting well that morning had settled him and returned things to the way they ought to be. Coffee the right color, the right temperature, and later today, quail without their brains would melt in his mouth. Every day the weather permitted, Deacon Morgan drove his brilliant black sedan 3/4 of a mile. From his own house on St. John Street, he turned right at the corner onto Central, past Luke, Mark, and Matthew, then parked neatly in front of the bank. The silliness of driving to where he could walk in less time than it took to smoke a cigar was eliminated, in his view, by the weight of the gesture. His car was big, and whatever he did in it was horsepower and worthy of comment. How he washed and waxed it himself, never letting KD or any enterprising youngster touch it. How he chewed but did not light cigars in it. How he never leaned on it. But if you had a conversation with him standing near it, he combed the hood with his fingernails, scraping flecks he alone could see, and buffing invisible stains with his pocket handkerchief. He laughed, along with friends, at his vanity, because he knew their delight at his weakness went hand in hand with their awe. The magical way he and his twin accumulated money, his prophetic wisdom, his total memory, the most powerful of which was one of his earliest. 42 years ago, he had fought for hand room in the rear window of Big Daddy Morgan's Model T, space in which to wave goodbye to his mother and baby sister Ruby. The rest of the family, Daddy, Uncle Pryor, his older brother Elder, and Steward, his twin, were packed tight against 2 peck baskets of food. The journey they were about to begin would take days, maybe 2 weeks. The second grand tour, Daddy said. The last grand tour, laughed Uncle Pryor. The first one had been in 1910, before the twins had been born, while Haven was still struggling to come alive. Big Daddy drove his brother Pryor and his firstborn son, Elder, all over the state and beyond to examine, review, and judge other colored towns. They planned to visit 2 outside Oklahoma and 5 within: Boley, Langston City, Rentisville, Taft, Clearview, Mound Bayou, Nicodemus. In the end, they made it to only 4. Big Daddy, Uncle Pryor, and Elder spoke endlessly of that trip, how they matched wits with and debated preachers, pharmacists, dry goods store owners, doctors, newspaper publishers, school teachers, bankers. They discussed malaria, the booze bill, the threat of white immigrants, the problems with Creek freedmen, the trustworthiness of boosters, the practicality of high book learning, the need for technical training, the consequences of statehood, lodges, and the violence of whites, random and organized, that swirled around them. They stood at the edge of cornfields, walked rows of cotton. They visited print shops, elocution classes, church services, sawmills. They observed irrigation methods and storage systems. Mostly, they looked at land, houses, roads. 11 years later, Tulsa was bombed, and several of the towns Big Daddy, Pryor, and Elder had visited were gone. But against all odds, in 1932, Haven was thriving. The crash had not touched it. Personal savings were substantial. Big Daddy Morgan's bank had taken no risks, partly because white bankers locked him out, partly because the subscription shares had been well protected, and families shared everything, made sure no one was short. Cotton crop ruined, the sorghum growers split their profit with the cotton growers. A barn burned, The pine sappers made sure lumber accidentally rolled off wagons at certain places to be picked up later that night. Pigs rooted up a neighbor's patch. The neighbor was offered replacements by everybody and was assured ham at slaughter. The man whose hand was healing from a chopping block mistake would not get to the second clean bandage before fresh cord was finished and stacked. Having been refused by the world in 1890 on their journey to Oklahoma, Haven residents refused each other nothing, were vigilant to any need or shortage. The Morgans did not admit to taking pleasure in the failure of some of those colored towns. They carried the rejection of 1890 like a bullet in the brain. They simply remarked on the mystery of God's justice and decided to take the young twins and go on a second tour to see for themselves. What they saw was sometimes nothing, sometimes sad, and Deke remembered everything. Towns that looked like slaves.